White Network presents Hitler's Table Talk, Study Out. Reading and commentary on the after-dinner monologues delivered by Adolf Hitler from 1941 to 1944 and transcribed by AIDS.
Good afternoon and good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. I say that because I have to remember that it's only 5 o'clock on the West Coast. It's still bright daylight this time of year, and it'll just get lighter as we continue on for a little while. I'm Carolyn Yeager. And
I'm Ray Goodwin.
How are you doing tonight, Ray?
Doing well, thank you. And you?
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. Wow, we were both complaining about the seasonal allergies around here before the show. But once the show gets started, I just kind of cheer up once I hear that music. So I want to tell people that this is episode 3. It's Thursday, March 20th, 2014. And, I'm just going to skip this next part. I'm going to say that one thing I wanted to remind listeners of, which I was just reminded of this afternoon, I mean, just came to me, that we're dealing in July 1941, and it was on May 10th, 1941, that Rudolf Hess flew to Scotland. And that was a big upheaval for Adolf Hitler and his government, and they, they had to handle that. They had to deal with that, but you wouldn't know from reading this. I mean, I didn't even think about it that it had happened just such a short time ago, and of course, Martin Bormann was Rudolf Hess's secretary. And when Hess was gone and not going to be coming back, Bormann was raised to the job of Hitler's personal secretary. And I was thinking that he was probably doing the work already. He's such a hard worker and such a workhorse. And so Rudolf Hess probably had him doing, you know, all that stuff, you know, a lot of it. And so he was familiar with it, and that's why he was the natural choice. And he just went on and continued. So, anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting to keep in mind. So, if you want to comment, did you have any interesting personal responses from last week's reading, Ray, in your own sphere that people comment to you about it or anything?
No, I haven't heard anything except a couple of people, friends of mine here that I'd discuss some of this with, and the book and the purpose of it, and they seem, you know, well, that's of historical interest, but anyway, that's about all it amounts to here.
Yeah, so you do, that's what I was meaning, if you had any acquaintances or friends that were listening to this and comment to you about it. I'm going to start the reading tonight. And we're starting with the night of the 21st and 22nd of July, 1941. And the topics are gratitude to the Jesuits, Protestant fanaticism, similarities between Germany and Italy, Dante and Luther, the Duce is one of the Caesars, the March on Rome, a turning point in history. Those two should go together. Delightful Italian towns and Rome and Paris. So Hitler says, and ladies and gentlemen, I am going to read all the way through, or almost all the way through this, before I comment, rather than confusing you by commenting after every couple sentences. I always have something I want to say or point out, but I'm going to refrain from doing that. So This is going to be pure Hitler here, and then we'll do all our commenting at the end. When all said, we should be grateful to the Jesuits. Who knows if, but for them, we would have abandoned Gothic architecture for the light, airy, bright architecture of the Counter-Reformation. Well, I do have to comment here. Sorry. Because this is where the translators actually have, we might have abandoned Gothic architecture. And that's very common that Germans translated that way into English, but for these kind of words. But it gives the wrong impression. So what Hitler is actually saying here is that because of the Jesuits, we did abandon Gothic architecture for the brighter, lighter, airier architecture of the Counter-Reformation. And so he is approving of that, and he is not so approving of the Gothic as maybe being, maybe he's not disapproving of it, but it was time for it to, you know, allow something brighter and cheerier to take its place. So that's a little change I made, and I thought that was really hard to follow. I couldn't really make out the sense of it for quite a while until I figured out that I needed to change might to would. All right, now continuing. He says, in the face of Martin Luther's efforts to lead an upper clergy that had acquired profane habits back to mysticism, the Jesuits restored to the world the joy of the senses. Okay, I've got a little... I've got some notes here in my way. It's certain that Luther had no desire to mold humanity to the letter of the scriptures. He has a whole series of reflections in which he clearly sets himself against the Bible. He recognizes that it contains a lot of bad things. Fanaticism is a matter of climate, for Protestantism, too, has burnt its witches. Nothing of that sort in Italy. The Southerner has a lighter attitude toward matters of faith. The Frenchman has personally an easy way of behaving in his churches. With us, it's enough not to kneel to attract attention. But Luther had the merit of rising against the Pope and the organization of the church. It was the first of the great revolutions. And thanks to his translation of the Bible, Luther replaced our dialects by the great German language. It's remarkable to observe the resemblances between the evolution of Germany and that of Italy. The creators of the language, Dante and Luther, rose against the ecumenical desires of the papacy. Each of the two nations was led to unity against the dynastic interests by one man. They achieved their unity against the will of the Pope. He's referring there to by one man to Dante in Italy and Luther in Germany. I must say I always enjoy meeting the Duce. He's a great personality. It's curious to think that at the same period as myself, he was working in the building trade in Germany. Our program was worked out in 1919, meaning the program of the NSDAP. And at that time, I knew nothing about him. Our doctrines are based on the foundations proper to each of them, but every man's way of thinking is the result. Don't suppose that events in Italy had no influence on us. The brown shirt would probably not have existed without the black shirt. The march on Rome in October 1922 was one, maybe I put that in there, I don't know, was one of the turning points of history. The mere fact that anything of the sort could be attempted and could succeed gave us an impetus. A few weeks after the March on Rome, I was received by the Minister Schreyer. That would never have happened otherwise. If Mussolini had been outdistanced by Marxism, I don't know whether we could have succeeded in holding out. At that period, National Socialism was a very fragile growth. If the Duce were to die, it would be a great misfortune for Italy. As I walked with him in the gardens of the Via Borghese, I could easily compare his profile with that of the Roman bust, and I realized he was one of the Caesars. There's no doubt at all that Mussolini is the heir of the great men of that period. Despite their weaknesses, the Italians have so many qualities that make us like them. Well, I'm going to comment right here, take a little break here, and say that I think that what he means there is that so many qualities that make us like them. He doesn't mean that that makes us similar to them, but he means like them as in enjoying them or, you know, enjoying being around them. What do you say, Ray?
I think that's exactly right. And he's, to me, he's referring to the Italians' appreciation for art, music, and the refinements of life.
Yeah, and he also sees, likes to look, see the Roman in the Italians.
Oh, yes.
If he can. Well, do you want to say anything about any other things? Do you have any notes there? You want to say anything about what I've read so far, what we've read so far?
Well, just that one sentence there, don't suppose that events in Italy had no influence on us. That packs a wallop, you know. It's and him saying that that Schweier would never have granted him audience had it not been for the movement in Italy. And I think it's important that people understand that. Hitler was, his movement was not in a vacuum, and it was certainly influenced down south by the Italian movement under Il Duce.
Right, right. And then there are other things going on. There are people who make a big deal about all kinds of previous movements that say Hitler was just, you know, taking advantage of what had already been done by all these people who most of us never heard of. But I wouldn't say it was that. I wouldn't go that far at all because they didn't do what he did, and he wasn't that aware. It was kind of like when things are in the air and people are having similar ideas. And you can't say that the first one who first talked about it is the one who determined it all. But I found it interesting that he usually speaks well of the Jesuits. And, you know, we have all these people who in conspiracy theory movement, call it that, who have this big theory about the Jesuits being behind all the evil in the world and all the usury and the, not the Jews, but the Jesuits and so on, and the Pope and the Vatican and what have you. Well, Hitler would not have agreed with that. They're usually anti-Hitler people, too, though, you have to say. But I've spoken to a number of, well, there are some National Socialists I've known who say, who are German or Austrian, and they were educated by the Jesuits, and they said Jesuits, they liked the Jesuits because they improved education, and they were great educators, and they felt they got that excellent education because of the Jesuits. And I think the Jesuits were not so, they were more independent. They were not so, they didn't follow along, you know, on the same old path. They kind of broke ground. But I have never studied about it, so I don't want people to say, you know, put something on me that I stand for this or that. But in this case, Hitler appreciated the opening up of things, and that shows his more scientific and joy-loving mind than he did over and above the dark old gothic and mystical type of thinking. Even though he was very spiritual and all of that, he didn't go for the a mysticism of the, you know, the deeper sort. So there's that, and then his praising Luther. He's famous for praising Luther for translating the Bible in German, and therefore giving an example to all Germans for what the German language was. And so he had this desire always to unify Germans, and not to have them all in different little sects and regions and so on. He was always a great unifier, and he continued to be even beyond just Germans in his ideas about Europe, which I'm sure we'll get into sometime. So, and then you spoke about how much you liked Il Duce, which was, you know, He liked him so much, and Duce was a big benefit to him, but finally became not a benefit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, let's see, where was I now?
Despite
okay. Italy. Italy is a country where intelligence, I'm back to Hitler now, intelligence created the notion of the state. The Roman Empire is a great political creation, the greatest of all. The Italian people's musical sense is its liking for harmonious proportions, the beauty of its race. The Renaissance was the dawn of a new era in which Aryan man found himself anew. There's also our own past on Italian soil. A man who is indifferent to history is a man without hearing, without sight. Such a man can live, of course, but what a life. When he means our own past, he means the Germans who have been in Italy. There was a German inner mixing, I would think, with the northern Italians. And then there's the Tyrolean area. So he says, the magic of Florence and Rome, of Ravenna, Siena, Perugia, Tuscany, and Umbria, how lovely they are. The smallest palazzo in Florence or Rome is worth more than all Windsor Castle. If the English destroy anything in Florence or Rome, it will be a crime. In Moscow, it wouldn't do any great harm, nor in Berlin, unfortunately. I've seen Rome and Paris, and I must say that Paris, with the exception of the Arc de Triomphe, has nothing on the scale of the Colosseum, or the Castle of San Angelo, or St. Peter's. These are monuments, which are the product of a collective effort, have ceased to be on the scale of the individual. There's something queer about the Paris buildings, whether it's those bullseye windows so badly proportioned, or those gables that obliterate whole facades. If I compare the Pantheon in Rome with the Pantheon in Paris, what a poor building, and what sculptures. What I saw in Paris has disappeared from my memory. Rome really seized hold of me. Well, I know that he was in Paris in June 1940, but I don't recall now when he was in Rome. But going on, he says, when the Duce came to Berlin, we gave him a magnificent reception. But our journey in Italy, that was something else. The reception when we arrived with all the ceremonial, the visit to the Quirinal. Well, he's very impressed with that. Naples, apart from the castle, might be anywhere in South America. But there's always a courtyard of the royal palace. What nobility of proportions. My dearest wish would be to wander about in Italy as an unknown painter. Well, that's the last of that night's conversation. And you can really tell that these are just highlights of what he was saying, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about that last part?
Yeah, that very last sentence you read there, Carolyn, my dearest wish would be able to wander about in Italy as an unknown painter. That, of course, was escapism, an escape thing for him to say. All of a sudden, he would be out from under so much stress about the military campaign and what lies ahead in his job as leader of his people and all. And he's thinking about how much Rome impressed him, how much Italy impressed him, and that his dearest wish would be able to wander about in Italy as an unknown painter. That just is a flight of fancy for him, and I can imagine him smiling thinking that.
Yeah, but I think at the same time, he always held that, and he always he had such a natural love of art. I mean, he was an artist in his personality and his soul. He really was. But see, he was so many things that he could go ahead and be this powerful leader too. But he always said to many people on many occasions that he kind of grieved that he couldn't spend his time with art and even mm-hmm. enjoying conversation with artists and everything, especially right. in these years when he said he had to be talking to those generals all the time, mm-hmm. you know, who were so boring. Instead of he would have liked to be talking to artists. But if he was talking to the artists, he'd probably be thinking he was missing something else.
So, that's right.
I wanted to point out that, let's see, that he really, well, I've already said it, but I'll say it one more time. When he talks about art, when he talks about architecture, and so on, he's not putting on, and he did have the ability to criticize the architecture that he found in various places. Mm-hmm. He was very advanced and knowledgeable, and he had taste also. And so, in this he was unusual on the world stage as far as leaders go, because mm-hmm. at that time and at any time, if any world leaders have any art appreciation, they don't, you know, they don't really have any, but Hitler really did.
Right.
And they, you know, the other leaders like Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin and so on at that time, and any others who weren't from such big countries maybe, they didn't have even a fingertip of the knowledge about arts that Hitler had, and yet they portrayed him as the dolt, you know, uneducated yes. dolt, and the mm-hmm. person whose taste was just for kitsch and junk and so on. It's just, you know, it's like with everything about him, he's so maligned, and everything they say is the exact opposite. I'm looking forward to the day when he's recognized for yes. being the great art expert that he was, and the person
who
did so much in that area. Okay, well, that's interesting. Now it's your turn.
Okay. The night of the 22nd and 23rd of July, 1941. And keep in mind, this is just the Operation Barbarossa. The invasion of the Soviet Union was only 1 month old at this time, and everything is going quite well for the German military. The subheadings for this part right here, British arrogance, the birth of German industry, trade competition with Britain, steps towards a durable understanding between Germany and Britain, dearth of philosophic and artistic sense of the British. The Englishman is superior to the German in one respect, that of pride. Only the man who knows how to give orders has pride. Everywhere in the world, Germans are working without getting the wages they deserve. Their abilities are recognized, but the fact that they live solely by their work makes them an object of contempt to the people whom they enrich. That's the reason why, in the period just before the First World War, the German got so little sympathy in the Anglo-Saxon world. Around 1870, we had a huge excess population, with the result that every year between 200,000 and 300,000 of our people had to make up their minds to emigrate. The remedy for this state of affairs would have been to incorporate them in the labor cycle. The only form of production that could be considered was that of the German primary materials, coal and steel. In this field, the needs of the market had until then been covered by England. The English demanded the best and paid high prices to get it. In these conditions, anyone who wants nevertheless to do business has only one solution, to ask lower prices. Our desperation for work enabled us to produce cheap, mass-produced articles that could nevertheless compete with English goods on the quality level. We were beginners and did not know all the secrets of manufacture. Thus it was that during the 80s, at a world exhibition in Philadelphia, German production was called shoddy. Nevertheless, with time, we were able to outclass English work in three sectors of production: the chemical industry, especially as regards pharmaceutical products, the manufacture of dyes, and just before the First World War, the extraction of nitrogen from the air, the production of electrical apparatus, and the production of optical instruments. England felt this competition so keenly that she reacted with all her strength. But neither her attempts at tariff protection nor certain international agreements, nor the compulsory use of the phrase made in Germany as a label for our goods made any difference at all. For the English, the ideal existence was represented in the society of the Victorian age. At that time, England had at her service the countless millions of her colonial empire, together with her own 35 million inhabitants. On top of that, a million bourgeois, and to crown the lot, thousands of gentlefolk who, without trouble to themselves, reap the fruit of other people's toil. For this ruling caste, Germany's appearance on the scene was a disaster. As soon as we started our economic ascent, England's doom was sealed. It's quite certain that in future, England's empire won't be able to exist without the support of Germany. I believe that at the end of this war will mark the beginning of a durable friendship with England. But first, we must give her the KO, meaning knockout, for only so can we live at peace with her, and the Englishman can only respect someone who has first knocked him out. The memory of 1918 must be obliterated. G.D. asked the Fuhrer whether Germany was fortified against the dangers of overeasy living, which were threatening to be the ruin of England. Yes, and that's why I pay attention to the arts. Amongst the English, culture, like sport, is a privilege of good society. Just imagine, in no country is Shakespeare so badly acted as in England. They love music, but their love is not returned. Besides, they have no thinker of genius. What does the National Gallery mean there to the mass of the people? It's like their social reform. It wasn't called for, like German reform, by the needs of conscience, but solely by reasons of state. At Bayreuth, one meets more Frenchmen than Englishmen. Quote me the example of a single theater in England where work is done that compares with the work we do in hundreds of theaters. But I've met a lot of Englishmen and English women whom I respect. Let's not think too much about those whom we know, with whom we've had those deceptive official dealings. They're not men. Despite everything, it's only with the people that we can associate.
Yeah, well, he covered a lot there, didn't he?
Yeah, he certainly did. I think the main gist of that was to take a swipe at England, saying that they needed to be taught a lesson, but that England and Germany, he foresaw when that war was over, of them being partners and able to exist for the good of all of Europe in unification.
Well, that was always his vision.
Yes, that's right.
But I think by this time he was becoming more critical of the British than he probably had been before.
Yeah, that's why he said they needed to be knocked out, because they won't respect you until you do knock them out.
Yes, and he thought that winning some battles would knock them out, but it didn't knock them out in their mind. They didn't have any intention of accepting being knocked out. Now, But he brings up the economic competition and the industrial competition.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting to hear how he words this.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that that made in Germany. See, I had never thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
That at that time, made in Germany was not a good
recommendation
for the goods.
That's right. When I was a little boy, we would see items, toys and things like this that had made in Japan on them, and they would always be laughed at, as inferior, as shoddy. And that's exactly what he's alluding to here.
Yeah. And now Japan is okay, but now it's made in China.
That's right. That's correct.
In China, we can laugh at. Pretty soon it's not going to be China either. It's going to be USA probably. So the British passed some laws, and some international agreements, and you had to put the country it was made in, thinking that that would hurt the Germans by having to say that their products were made in Germany. And he says that the Germans were forced to cut to charge less in order to compete in the beginning.
Yeah, to get business. And that business was at the expense of England. And therefore, England's inner circle went to work right away to get rid of the competition in any way they could. That was the British balance of power policy that they conducted against any nation in Europe that dared arise. And that policy was designed to keep everybody in subservience to the British as far as economics business went.
Well, that's so true. And, you know, you think about what made, you know, they thought that they had the right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about that to Richard Edmonds, but I didn't get very far with it because I didn't want to be knocking the British. And I don't want to knock the British anyway. But, mm-hmm. But you know, they do have a certain, they probably still have it in them. But the people are more even-minded. So it really is the British establishment that feels they need to stay on top of everything. Mm-hmm. But they still think that they have this idea that they can do to other people whatever is necessary in order to keep themselves mm-hmm. on top. And that's very similar to the Jewish.
That's exactly
idea,
right. That's an excellent parallel.
Well, and I sometimes want to wonder if, you know, I just want to think about it with people, if that's because they got so many Jews in their country or were they mm-hmm. like that anyway? It's mm-hmm. not from the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, you know, you could say it was, but at one point they've been. That's why we went all the way back to the Norman invasion of
mm-hmm.
King. What was his name now? Can't remember, but who came over there and was very bloodthirsty?
William the Conqueror.
William the Conqueror. Thank mm-hmm. you, Ray. Yeah. And then this, he says that now he's making fun of them by saying that, they don't really appreciate their artists, the English,
mm-hmm.
and that they're not for the mass of the people either, but he says that that's not the way it is in Germany.
Right.
So I think he's kind of talking Germany as superior to the English now,
mm-hmm.
but he's not happy with the elites, and he does want to point out that the people are okay,
mm-hmm.
and that we have to think in terms of in these other countries that it's the people that we can associate with reach out to,
mm-hmm.
Not the elites, because that's what National Socialism would be, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Move on to the next topic.
Yeah, you are going to read those short ones.
Okay, the night of the 24th and 25th of July, 1941, subheadings, the qualities of the German soldier, SS losses pay dividends, weaknesses of the German high command in 1914-18. I can say that I've never doubted the qualities of the German soldier, which is more than I can say even of some of the chiefs of the Wehrmacht. The German army is technically the most perfect in the world, and the German soldier, in a moment of crisis, is safer and sounder than any other soldier. I'm truly happy that it has been granted to me to see in my lifetime the German soldier rewarded by Providence. For an elite force like our SS, it's great luck to have suffered comparatively heavy losses. In this way, it's assured of the necessary prestige to intervene if need be on the home front, which of course won't be necessary. But it's good to know that one disposes of a force that could show itself capable of doing so on occasion. It's marvelous to see how our Gauleiters are everywhere in the breach. I cannot tell you how greatly I suffered during the Great War from the weaknesses of our command. In a military sense, we were not at all clever. And in a political sense, we were so clumsy that I had a constant longing to intervene. If I'd been Reich Chancellor at the period, in 3 months' time, I'd have cut the throat of all obstruction, and I'd have reasserted our power. If I were 20 to 25 years younger, I'd be in the front line. I passionately loved soldiering. And there's a lot in that little part right there, Carolyn.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that's true, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
He certainly proved that. In the First World War, he went in as soon as he could and stayed into the end, and then he didn't even want it to end, you know? And people point out today, these, more of these conspiracy theorists, that, he didn't quit, because he was such a weak person, and he couldn't make a living, so he stayed in the army as long as he could because he got a meal and a roof over his head because he was just such a nobody. But I think he stayed in because he hated to leave, and he hated the fact that it was all over for him as far as being a soldier. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he said he wished he his greatest love would have been to wander around Italy as a painter. Now he says, well, he passionately loves he would be a soldier today. Mm-hmm. But they're both true. So,
you know, this one statement, I want to see bounce this off of you and see if it struck you as it did me. Of course, Hitler and a ton of the military men felt like they had been betrayed at home during World War One, towards the end, by their inept politicians and sellouts. Mm-hmm. And I think, of course, that's what to me he's referring to when he talks about the SS. And he said, having an elite force like that, they are assured of having the necessary prestige to intervene if need be on the home front, which of course won't be necessary. But what I think to me, what he was referring to there was the traitors, in Berlin, who were selling them out, and diddle dallying around, if we would have had a force like this, we could have acted back then. And if anything like that came necessary now, we could do it, but he said, of course, it won't be necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I did get the idea. And first, I thought it was important that he was talking about he was happy to see the German soldier rewarded by Providence. And I didn't get that at first, and I was trying to understand it. Finally, Kurt came to me that it was that the German soldier wasn't respected like he should have been back then.
He
knew that now in this new war, the German soldier is respected in every way, not only by him and his government, but by the people. And the whole thing is different. And he's comments in other places, other times, about how he doesn't understand how some countries don't respect their soldiers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Cause he certainly does. Yeah, and this other, it's that the SS has got the prestige and they've got the trust of the people that if they had to intervene inside Germany, you know, amongst the Germans, that they would probably be able to do it. They wouldn't. Mm-hmm. There would be no revolt against them or anger or whatever. So.
And his words about the SS there rang a note with me, because when I was in high school, my dad had a friend that had been a veteran of World War II, had been wounded fighting in Europe. And I sat and talked with him one day when we were fishing and asked him a little bit about the campaign over there. And he said he had been moving from France into Germany. And I said, well, how were the soldiers and, on the German side? And he said, the regular German army was plenty tough. He said they were excellent fighters and everything. But he said, I'll tell you what, if you ran up against one of those units in black, he said, you better bring your lunch and plan to stay there a while. Because they were as tough a soldier that he had ever seen. And,
he was in what, did you say?
He was in the United States Army. Yes, in the push from France into Germany.
Okay.
After D-Day.
Oh, yeah. Well, the SS was really standing up against that. It was a hopeless battle, but they were doing it anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. They killed a lot of Americans. Because they wouldn't allow them, just wouldn't lay down and let them go through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, the Americans were all upset, and the soldiers, what I've read, and even from on that side, that their soldiers were really, really unhappy and crying because they were being beat to heck by certain SS units in certain places, being slaughtered, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, But the way they went about it was just push them through there. We'll get through if we just keep throwing men in there. And that's what they did.
And that's that same fella, that Army veteran, he said, when we did manage to take the ground we were after, we caught a handful of prisoners. He said those Germans would look at us when they were walking by, and he said his last name was Meisler. He was of German heritage, and he said they would look at him and they would see that Meisler on his uniform. So they would say in German to him. He said one of them told him it would have been good to see how you guys would have done against us, just us two fighting. Instead of us having to fight the Russians to our back over here as well as you guys. And he said, if you guys would have had to take us on one-on-one, you couldn't have done it. And that's what they, you know, would say to him like that. And he said they also said about the Soviets advancing, they said they would tell him stuff like, what are you going to do when they turn their guns on you? Referring to the Russians, of course. So that was some very, very interesting conversations with that fellow, and I'm glad that he shared those with me.
Well, me too. What did he think today? Well, that was not today, but when you were a young guy.
Yeah, that was back when I was in high school and first year.
Did he indicate he had respect for them?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Yeah. So that was refreshing. To hear those words, you know, it was very honest, and it was a soldier talking. It was not someone who had been contaminated with political bullcrap.
Yeah. Well, so, that's very moves me quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that.
Sure.
Okay, why don't you go on, and if you want to say some more, or else, but you go on and read these rest of these short ones.
Yeah, we'll just go right ahead with these rather quick notes. Friday, 25th of July, 1941, midday. Romania must become an agricultural country. Romania would do well to give up, as far as possible, the idea of having her own industry. She would direct the wealth of her soil, and especially her wheat, towards the German market. She would receive from us, in exchange, the manufactured goods that she needs. Bessarabia is a real granary. Thus, the Romanian proletariat, which is contaminated by Bolshevism, would disappear. And the country would never lack anything. I must own that King Carol has worked in that direction. Friday. Go ahead.
Let me just say this real quick. Now here's where, once again, Hitler is showing his idea that you could have, these countries could be in a kind of a league together.
Yes.
And everybody could do what they are best at. And of course, Hitler was interested in getting agricultural products and food products to Germany. Knowing that they needed them, and he thought if everybody was trying to do everything, it wasn't as smart as if, like Romania and Ukraine too, were great agriculture, had great land and, fertile land and so on, and should do the farming and, let the Germans and some others do the industrial output, and then they could all live happily ever after. But you have to trust one another to do that.
That's right.
Because if Romania would give up its industry and just do farming, say, basically, and then all of a sudden there'd be disputes with Germany or what have you, and then they'd be up a creek. But everybody can be up a creek.
Sure.
But you see, I know that Hitler was an honorable man, and he knew the Germans were honorable and that this could all be worked out. But other people either were not as honorable, or they didn't trust, and maybe they thought they were smart not to trust all that. And you know, there are a lot of other things that could go on that could make that not work out so well. That was again beyond anybody's help, maybe. So you know, that's why it's hard to do things like this.
Sure. Well,
okay, that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, Friday, July 25th, 1941, evening. Anglo-American rivalries. England and America will one day have a war with one another, which will be waged with the greatest hatred imaginable. One of the two countries will have to disappear.
What do you think of that?
I think he's talking about dog-eat-dog Jewish capitalism. Both countries' money systems controlled by the Jews and economic warfare against each other and you know, supposedly be allies, mother country, and all this good stuff, but really it was dog eat dog behind the scenes.
Well, that's one thought. I think he's seeing England as stronger than it was even at that time, as though England could even compete with the United States. And certainly England collapsed after the war. It was all, you know,
right,
used up everything. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I don't see that ever happening. You know, that England
right.
wouldn't possibly wage war against the United
no.
States. The United States is too strong.
That's right.
So whatever he was envisioning on that evening, I think he didn't come to pass.
Right.
Yeah.
Saturday, 26th of July, 1941, night. Monarchy is doomed. The people needs a point upon which everybody's thoughts converge, an idol. A people that possess a sovereign of the stature of Frederick the Great can think itself happy. But if he's just an average monarch, it's better to have a republic. Notice that when the institution of monarchy has been abolished in a country, see France and Yugoslavia today, thenceforward, the institution is given over to ridicule, can never again assert itself. I'm tempted to believe that the same thing will happen with the church. Both are institutions that naturally develop in the direction of ceremonial and solemnity. But all that apparatus no longer means anything when the power that lay beneath it has disappeared.
Yeah. Well, you know, that really, I probably shouldn't spend any time talking about that, but he's just basically saying that he likes the ceremonial. People like things that are ceremonial and solemn. And appear to have meaning, but if there's no power in it any longer,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't mean anything, and then you start having ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what's happened to the Pope. I mean, look at how the Pope has to be just a real nice guy now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd go around making friends with everybody, mm-hmm. where it didn't used to be that way. Everybody just respected him because
that's right. They checked to the power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so that we will finish this, I'm going to read Sunday, the 27th of July. Oh, and I guess there's a 28th, too, so I'll get right on here. This is the evening, 27 July, 1941. I'm not even going to read those headings. Hitler says, "It is striking to observe to what a degree a people's place in the world is a function of its age. A young nation is compelled to constant success. An old nation can allow itself continual setbacks, Germany and England. We must take care to prevent a military power from ever again establishing itself on this side of the Urals, for our neighbors to the west would always be allied with our neighbors to the east. That's how the French once made common cause with the Turks, and now the English are behaving in the same fashion with the Soviets. When I say on this side of the Urals, I mean a line running 200 or 300 kilometers east of the Urals, a little beyond the Urals. It should be possible for us to control this region to the east with 250,000 men, plus a cadre of good administrators. Let's learn from the English, who with 250,000 men in all, including 50,000 soldiers, govern 400 million Indians. This space in Russia must always be dominated by Germans." Well, he means that place up to that point of the Urals.
Mm-hmm.
"Nothing would be worse mistake on our part than to seek to educate the masses there. It is to our interest that the people should know just enough to recognize the signs on the roads. At present, they can't read, and they ought to stay like that. But they must be allowed to live decently, of course, and that's also to our interest. We'll take the southern part of the Ukraine, especially the Crimea, and make it an exclusive German colony. There'll be no harm in pushing out the population that's there now. The German colonists will be the soldier peasant, and for that I'll take professional soldiers, whatever their line may have been previously. In this way, we shall dispose, moreover, of a body of courageous NGOs whenever we need them. In future, we shall have a standing army of 1.5 to 2 million men. With the discharge of soldiers after 12 years of service, we shall have 30 to 40,000 men to do what we like with each year. For those of them who are sons of peasants, the Reich will put at their disposal a completely equipped farm. The soil costs us nothing. We have only the house to build. The peasant's son will already have paid for it by his 12 years service. During the last 2 years, he will already be equipping himself for agriculture. One single condition will be imposed upon him, that he may not marry a townswoman, but a countrywoman, who, as far as possible, will not have begun to live in a town with him. These soldier peasants will be given arms, so that at the slightest danger, they can be at their posts when we summon them. That's how the ancient Austria used to keep its eastern peoples under control. By the same token, the soldier peasant will make a perfect school teacher. The NCO is an ideal teacher, the non-commissioned officer is an ideal teacher for the little country boy. In any case, this NCO will make a better teacher than our present teacher will make an officer. Thus we shall find, we shall again find in the countryside the blessing of numerous families. Whereas the present law of rural inheritance dispossesses the younger sons, in future every peasant's son will be sure of having his patch of ground. And 30 to 40,000 peasants a year, that's enormous. In the Baltic states, we'll be able to accept as colonists some Dutch, some Norwegians, and even by individual arrangement, some Swedes. So there he is again with his kind of a empire.
Very forward thinking about European unity.
Yeah. Yeah, and people, some people will have some critical things to say about this, but why don't you go on and read the
yeah.
next one so we finish up the month of July, yeah. and then what time we have left we'll...
Okay, good idea. Night of 27th, 28th, July, 1941. It's in man's nature to act through his descendants. Some people think only of their family and house. Others are more far-sighted. For my part, I must say that when I meet children, I think of them as if they were my own. They all belong to me. The reason why I'm not worrying about the struggle on the Eastern Front is that everything that happens there is developing in the way that I've always thought desirable. At the outbreak of the First World War, many people thought we ought to look toward the mineral riches of the West, the raw materials of the colonies, and the gold. For my part, I always thought that having the sun in the East was the essential thing for us, and today I have no reason to modify my point of view. At the beginning of our movement, I acted above all by intuition. During my imprisonment, I had time to provide my philosophy with a natural historical foundation. From their own point of view, the rulers of the day made a miscalculation in locking me up. They would have been far wiser to let me make speeches all the time without giving me any respite. The National Socialist theory is to make use of all forces, wherever they may come from. I realize that the families that have dedicated themselves for generations to the service of the state contain good elements, and that the Bolsheviks made a mistake in their over-eagerness in exterminating the intelligentsia. But it is intolerable that the members of a class should suppose that they alone are competent to hold certain functions. The work that everybody is called on to supply cannot be judged by its objective value. Everyone has only one duty, to take trouble. Whoever does this duty becomes, by doing so, indispensable to the community, whether it is something that only he can do or that's within the capacities of anyone. Otherwise, the man who achieves something important, the effect of which can be felt for decades or even for centuries, would have a right to puff himself up and despise the man who sweeps the streets. The example set by the English aristocracy in wishing the eldest son of a family to be the only heir to the title is quite reasonable. Thus, the younger sons go back to the people, and the family retains its economic power whilst at the same time keeping its bonds with the people. When somebody remarks with an air of sorrowful sympathy that such and such an outcast from an ancient family is a useless creature, a tramp, a failure. Very good. It's right that a healthy family should eject one of its members who has become unworthy of it. The error would be precisely to allow the failure to continue to be privileged. It goes without saying that only a planned economy can make intelligent use of all of a people's strength. Daray has done two good things, the law of agrarian inheritance and the regulation of markets. If in future we obtain the primary materials that the shortage has compelled us to replace by synthetic products, a thing we could do thanks to our scientific researches and our superior technique, that will be no reason to stop producing those synthetic products.
All right. That's really a good... I thought that was pretty impressive.
I did, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, of course, Daray is the was the National Socialist ideologist, and he even served as Reich Minister of Food and Agriculture from 1933 to 1942. He's associated with the Blut und Boden, blood and soil philosophy of National Socialism. He was 100% loyal National Socialist and was in the SS too.
Mm-hmm.
So he mentions him. And he says that only a planned economy is good, you know? I mean, he believes in a planned economy.
Mm-hmm.
That's straight out there. There's no question about it.
That's right.
For those who don't.
It cuts down on so much wasted effort and scattered forces and things like that. And you know, he drew that picture of the healthy family should eject one of its members who has become unworthy of that family. The error would be precisely to allow the failure to continue to be privileged. Immediately, I think of England and their ruling elite and spoil brats occasionally, you know, and worthless. And when I say worthless, I mean incompetent. People who have automatically, by blood, come into title. And even though they may be wastrels like Churchill, and you know, to contrast Hitler's idea there of, hey, throw them out, you know, just be rid of such a waste instead of letting them stay in and rot the whole barrel of apples, so to speak.
Well, yeah, and I thought of just the whole idea of the National Socialist State too, which followed that if somebody is working against it, or if you have unworthy, well, as we already said, unworthy, but you know, there, I can't think of the example that I had earlier, but you know that we have to be able to get rid of people who aren't any good.
Sure.
We can't feel like, well, we all have to, we're all together, we're all, as long as you're, Even in Germany, as long as you're German, well, you belong. Well, if you're a bad German, you can be ejected, he says.
Mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm. And by the same token, too, Carolyn, he wants us to, well, he wanted his nation to make use of even the lowest, the one that may seem to be just a peasant, but if that person has innate abilities that would benefit the state, you got to let them arise. You've got to take advantage of that talent.
Well, that's right. And there's that. And then there's that, you know, even a janitor, if you didn't have a janitor, who is probably the lowest on the scale anywhere, you know, who's going to clean up? You'd be all be sitting around here in dirt and rubble and stuff. So everybody plays their part. Well, we run out of time, and next week we'll be moving on into August. So good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour will return next week. exclusively on the White Network.